Buy spark plug coffee. Buy spark plug coffee. Buy spark plug coffee.
You know, I think I'm going to visit sparkplugcoffee.com and join the Spark Plug Coffee Club.
Yes!
Spark! What's happening to me, Spark?
Let exceptional coffee pull the puppet strings of your taste buds and make the switch to Spark Plug Coffee. Spark Plug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half-calf, and a rotating blend for the adventurous among you. But the best part is that Spark Plug custom roasts their beans when you order them and delivers them within 1 week so that they always reach you fresh and at their peak flavor, and you will taste the difference. You can order Spark Plug as you need it or join the Spark Plug Autopilot Coffee Club for regular deliveries. The Autopilot Coffee Club is not a coffee of the month club. It's completely personalized and flexible and comes with all kinds of member benefits. And we have great news for Top 100 listeners. If you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, and that's all one word with the number 100, Spark Plug is now offering 20% off your next coffee order. It applies to any size order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. So what are you waiting for? Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hi, Film Geekazoids, and thanks so very much for downloading the Next 173 Project, the nearly every Monday podcast that turns an eye to classic motion pictures. We got our start by reviewing the AFI's 1998 and 2007 groups of greatest movies. That quest ended in December 2015. We've been doing this longer than we ever did the original point of the podcast. So now what you get is us dissecting titles that have piqued our curiosity. This one really fits that bill. Warning, we spoil. I'm the guy who loves being in someone else's head so much that I don't even mind being dumped in a ditch afterwards. That was the greatest experience of my life. Ryan Ellis. And here's the lady who hasn't yet acquired a parrot to be my alarm clock, nor has she brought an emotionally disturbed monkey into our bed. My wife, Bev.
That's me.
I did say yet.
Listen, just don't let me go and pet find her.
Okay, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture. Being John Malkovich. Malkovich, Malkovich, Malkovich. If you could spend 10 or 15 minutes inside anyone's head, living, we'll say just living, not living or dead, so Jesus would be such an easy answer, something like that, who would it be?
So I thought it would be good to spend time in a body dramatically different from my own. So since I'm not a very athletic person, I thought Simone Biles. Or maybe like one of those acrobats from Cirque du Soleil.
Well, interesting choices. I went more brainy than physical. My first thought with this was Bill Clinton. Maybe even Hillary, but especially Bill Clinton, because I'd love to know the absolute truth about his many scandals.
Well, would you learn that if you just happened to watch him eating toast and reading the newspaper like Malkovich is doing? You don't get to see inside his thoughts.
Well, in my version of this, you do.
Okay. Well, if that's the case...
Actually, my second answer is probably better. It does fit the being John Malkovich thing better, which is Jeff Bridges, because he seems truly happy.
He does, it's true.
Whenever you see him interviewed, he's, hey man, everything's great, yeah. That recent Big Lebowski reunion with him, Buscemi, and John Goodman, who doesn't seem all that happy a lot of the time, actually. It's all this reminiscing, which is fun and all, but Bridges is one of those guys who I think gets it, but is also just so joyful. He has a cool wife he's been with forever. He's been in great movies. Everyone loves him.
Maybe so. I would get inside your head. And then I would just learn all these little psychological things I could use against you in our marriage.
You don't want to be there.
It's a dark place.
It's a dangerous place to be there. All right, so you want to be a gymnast, and I want to be the dude. Being John Malkovich was released by USA Films one day shy of 20 years ago on December 3rd in the excellent year of 1999. Excellent for movies, especially. Maybe not for everything in the world. We thought we were going to die there that year because of Y2K. It didn't cost much, nor did it make very much moolah. But since the movie is 20 years old, Bev, in one day, you should remind everyone what it's about with the Being John Malkovich skinnage.
Okay, I'm going to try my best here. John Cusack is Craig, an out-of-work puppeteer who takes a filing job at Lester Corp, where he discovers a portal that allows him to spend 15 minutes voyeuristically experiencing life from inside the mind of John Malkovich. Yes, that John Malkovich. Craig shows this portal to his work crush, Catherine Keener's Maxine, who begins exploiting it for profit. Craig's wife, Cameron Diaz's Lottie, discovers their scheme and then discovers that she loves the experience a little too much, particularly when it's paired with a developing sexual relationship between Malkovich and Maxine. Craig, jealous, locks Lottie up, permanently injures Malkovich, takes control of his body for himself. Lottie escapes, discovers that Craig's boss not only knows about the portal, but has been using it for generations to trade old bodies for younger ones in order to live forever. They cook up a scheme to expel Craig from Malkovich's mind, then Lottie and Maxine fall in love, Craig gets trapped in the prison of their child's mind.
That is the movie.
It's a lot of plot in this movie.
Very well done. Old people and their living forever stuff. God. Except the cycle of life, people. The circle of life, I should say. Well, I better nutshell, because that was a long one, although very well read. Almost as fast as I talk. Someone listened to this on 1.5 speed.
Oh my God.
What did she just say? So, in a nutshell, woman stops working 15-hour days so she can marry a puppeteer.
Yeah, they're both working pretty long hours there, aren't they?
Well, Maxine's the one who's always in the office, though. Craig isn't always. She's there, then she goes home for a while and goes back at 9 o'clock at night to work till 4 in the morning. And as someone online pointed out, she doesn't look very tired considering for weeks they've been doing this and she's working till the middle of the night. And then at one point goes to Malkovich's house, or his apartment, I guess, to boink him past 4 in the morning because Lottie wants to go there. But she says, after work, honey, sweetie. Sweetie, I guess she calls her, right? And Malkovich, incidentally, in reality, is married. So through all this movie, he is really cheating.
Well, it's not him. He has remarked, this is not really what he's like. And he took, as he said, a big risk agreeing to do this film because it was either a bomb that would forever be associated with his name or a success where he would forever be associated with this quasi-sleazy version of himself. Mm-hmm. And people would assume this is what he's really like.
Those are fair points, except he's an actor and his name is in the title of the movie. I think that would be enough to convince any actor.
Something that was funny to me that surprised me was I had totally always assumed when Charlie Kaufman wrote the script that he wrote that it could be anybody and Malkovich was the one that agreed to do it, so then they wrote it to customize it to John Malkovich. But that's not the case. He wrote it for John Malkovich without ever knowing if he would even read the script.
It'd be fun if it was someone like Tom Cruise or Jeff Bridges, Bill Clinton, even a famous gymnast like we've been talking about. But you pick an actor that we all know, sort of, in that Jewel Heist movie, which he was never in. He was in a Jewel Heist movie apparently a few years after this, actually, but he hadn't been at that point. But an actor we've seen in a lot of things, but really can't place him necessarily. Although, I guess Malkovich, for any film fan, they know who he is. He was so great in The Line of Fire about 6 years before this.
And the point is that it's just a coincidence that he's a famous actor. He was already the conduit, and he could have been anything. He could have been a taxi driver. He happened to become an actor, so it works that he's not the world's most famous actor. Like, what a coincidence that would be.
But famous in a way, more so than his daughter, who is the conduit at the end of the film. I have a second nutshell, incidentally.
Okay.
Last week was the Muppet movie. Well, this is the Puppet movie.
We did do two Puppet movies in a row.
Malk. Malkovich. Malkovich. We didn't pick that on purpose. That's just the way it worked out. Okay, a little bit of numbers action, then we'll get into the proper conversation. The Rotten Tomatoes numbers are very good. 93% of critics like this film, 124 fresh, 9 rotten. How do you not at least respect this movie enough to say, yes, you should see it? For an average of 8.1 out of 10. Pretty good numbers there, and 87% of audiences. It was 79th at the 1999 U.S. box office. The Phantom Menace was number 1. The Sixth Sense was number 2. We covered that, of course. The Matrix, we covered only a few months ago, was number 5. We've also covered American Beauty from that year. Chris and I did Any Given Sunday. You and I did other things I can't think of right now from that year. Dogma, earlier this year we covered that. One of my favorite years in the history of film, for sure, 1999. BJM was nominated for 3 Oscars, Best Director, Best Supporting Actress, and Best Original Screenplay. It lost out to American Beauty for 2 of those. And I looked just last night at the original screenplay nominees. A lot of good ones. This is the most original. They probably should have given it to this movie, but it was also the first film for the director, Spike Jones. I don't think it was Charlie Kaufman's first script.
His first one produced.
It was, okay, yeah. So maybe that's part of it.
Although I thought it was Human Nature, but Human Nature came 2 years after.
And that was Michel Gondry who directed that. They often want to reward young people, encourage them, so to speak, but that's maybe more so for actors, because this same year, Angelina Jolie, who was still pretty young in 1999, mid-20s, I guess she would have been, won the award, and justifiably, she was good in Girl Interrupted, but Catherine Keener is probably better.
Well, as far as the screenplay award goes, the original screenplay often seems to be kind of the consolation prize for films that appeal to younger people, something you might call hipster films.
At least a nomination. There's almost always one out of the 10, so adapted and original, that is a popular film or a movie of the moment from earlier that year. And a lot of times one of the actors maybe co-wrote it. I think of The Big Sick a couple years ago. People liked the movie, but no other nominations for it. But Kumail Nanjiani gets to go to the award show because, and here's an actor, but he co-wrote the movie.
And it was a really popular film that critics adored. And honestly, if you had only people under 40 voting in the Oscars, The Big Sick probably would have been nominated for Best Picture. Also, another great original screenplay. I don't think it won, you could tell me, is Eighth Grade.
Just wasn't nominated.
Wasn't even nominated?
It won, because that was the whole joke. We talked about that in the Oscar show earlier this year. Bo Burnham won the Writers Guild Award and said something like, won't see at the Oscars, losers, or have fun at the Oscars, losers.
He's so funny.
Because he got to win an award there, but didn't actually go to the show, which is absurd. And that was one of the best movies of last year, and one of the better screenplays of last year, Eighth Grade.
I thought of that just because it seems like exactly the kind of movie that gets a consolation prize from the Oscars, even though people 20, 30 years from now are going to recognize it as a better movie than, well, certainly than Green Book.
Well, I've talked before many times about how I love 1999, and the five nominees for Best Picture are all solid films, if not very good films. American Beauty, which we covered years ago. The Cider House Rules is fine. The Green Mile, I like quite a lot. The Insider, I haven't seen in a long time. I know you don't love that movie. I like it quite a bit. Russell Crowe is outstanding in that movie. And Pacino's pretty good, too. And then The Sixth Sense, which I've never been a huge fan of, but I can see why people like it so much. But this is one of those years where you could bump every one of those movies out and then put in something like Being John Malkovich, and I don't love it like a lot of other people do, but Fight Club, and we've talked a lot about Galaxy Quest and Bowfinger. I'm not saying these would be nominees, but then name another one to make that another set of five, and then knock all them out, and then find another five movies that could get in there, and then knock them out, and then find there's at least 20 movies in 1999 that are outstanding that could be nominated for Best Picture, in my opinion. Would they have been? No. But those are all good ones. And Being John Malkovich was the one movie. There's almost always one that gets nominated for Best Picture, but then somebody else gets nominated for director. Well, that was Spike Jonze for this movie. And Green Mile, Frank Darabont didn't get nominated as the director of his film. Being John Malkovich was also nominated for two AFI lists. Didn't make either of them. The top 100 genres in the fantasy category. It'd be tough to break into that one. There's some good entries in that one, but this would have been very appropriate. And also the 2007 AFI Top 100. And as I said recently on Three Kings, that was also nominated for that second list. That was a big year for nominees, 1999. I think there was eight that got nominated for that second AFI list.
Film people acknowledge that 99 was just a supernaturally exceptional year for film.
They had to get their movies in while they still could, because we were all going to die.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Nothing happened.
Hurry!
Nothing happened. All right, finally, what do you think of the weird and delightful Being John Malkovich? But also, before you make your point, sad Being John Malkovich. This movie is not as joyful as I remembered it being.
Oh, no, it's kind of a downer with a pretty dark ending. First, I'm going to start with a question, which is, whatever became of the golden age of Charlie Kaufman movies? He got sad, he stopped making comedies, we just got gifted with these weird, delightful, bizarre films in the late 90s and the early aughts, and I don't know, then he just changed his tone, and I miss this Charlie Kaufman. There's just the initial delight of just following his story where it leads you without dreaming of predicting where it's going. Then there's a secondary pleasure of how remarkably and enduringly funny it is. It is hilarious. Perhaps it's a little tonally inconsistent.
Yeah.
And I think it lacks a depth in character. So it's kind of hard to truly get drawn into the story the way, say, another Kaufman film, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, does. But that's just what makes it fall short of being a masterpiece, because what works in Being John Malkovich is enough to make it still just such an absolute delight 20 years later.
I think this reminds me a lot of the movie we covered a few weeks ago, Three Kings, where it's extremely funny. Well, this is even more so funny early on, but the middle section, not so much. And at the end, there's definitely some laughs. When Malkovich goes into his own brain and comes out, the beer can be thrown in his head, all that kind of stuff is pretty funny. And that's more towards the middle of the end, maybe the last third of the film. But it's more the setup that's funny, because it does become, not dour, it's still weird and cool, but sad. The one guy's trying to explain to Maxine and Craig why he wants to go in the brain. $200, please. Oh, okay, here you go. But this guy's got some real problems.
Yes, part of the reason it's sad is that it really does come down to you have nobody to root for in this movie. The best you could do for a character that you want to win would be Lottie, who's flawed in her own way.
Maybe Malkovich, the victim in all this?
You feel bad for him in the intellectual way, but it's not like this is his sad story, or even close.
He loses his mind for 8 months, though.
I know.
Because Craig takes him over.
There's going to be a version of this film told entirely from the point of view of Charlie Sheen. I totally forgot.
Machine!
I totally forgot that Charlie Sheen was in this movie. His cameo is so
that
funny.
Bald wig.
Oh my God.
One of the great lines in the great screenplay is simply him saying, Machine! And he opens the door to him at the end.
actually, no, the best line comes about 2 minutes later when he's telling Sheen about the portal and how they're going to live forever. And he's like, we could invite others. Maybe Gary Sinise.
That's a good inside joke line because Malkovich and Sinise were buddies in the Steppenwolf Theater in Chicago. And I think you see Sinise very briefly in a picture during the little documentary special about him as a puppeteer towards the end of the film. That's when the movie gets funny again, incidentally, if it hadn't been funny for a while, and it still is here and there in the last third or so of the film. But when we see that sequence, that's definitely really funny. And you can see Sinise in the picture, but he and Malkovich are buddies from long ago, and they were in Of Mice and Men earlier this decade as well. Do you remember when you first saw this movie? Because I did not see this in the theater. I'd heard a little bit about it. I would see 60 or 70 movies a year back then. Maybe not quite that many in 1999, but quite a few. I know I saw American Beauty in the theater, and Green Mile, and Cider House Rules, and some of the other ones we talked about already. When I first saw it, I know I liked it, but sort of, as I mentioned earlier, Big Lebowski, the year before this, which I love now, and I liked it the first time I saw it. I think I've grown to like Being John Malkovich more as the years have gone on. Maybe because it's so original, although Cameron Diaz has said, there's 12 story ideas in Hollywood. This is the 13th. It's true, but as someone else pointed out a long time ago, really, in the end, it's a love rhombus, love triangle, actually, with Cusack, Diaz, and Keener. But bring Malkovich into it, because he's always the pawn of Craig or Lottie. Then again, at times, he's just himself with Maxine at 4 o'clock in the morning wearing a full-on suit in his apartment. Shall we to the boudoir? He's still himself in that moment. And the reason I say 4 in the morning is because that's when Maxine's working. She closes down JM Inc. at about 4 in the morning, and she meets Malkovich at that time. But really, in the end, it's a love story. This movie's obsessed with, well, really more so than love, is sex. If I may paraphrase Martin Short when he talked about John McCain, the only time he's not thinking of peeing is when he's peeing. The only time these characters aren't thinking about sex is when they're having sex. These four people. In indirect ways, because Cusack and Diaz never actually have actual sex with anyone that we see. I guess it's implied at the end that Diaz and Keener, who become a lesbian couple, must be having sex. But Cusack is always doing it through Malkovich when he's involved. Well, he's only involved a little bit when he makes his hand move and grabs her boob and that kind of thing. But the movie is obsessed with these four people, at least, always thinking about connecting in that way and literally connecting in that way.
I would say it's less about sex and more about desire. It's not like Craig would just be satisfied if Maxine was sleeping with him. He's in love with her, but he kind of wants to possess her.
I think he's in lust with her. He barely knows her, but he says he's in love with her.
Yeah, fine, but I think it's more about what desire does to the human brain and the lengths that we will go to have our love requited.
The heart wants what it wants is what Woody Allen said many years ago, and maybe that fits here because Craig has no reason to think that Maxine wants him back. He's in the friend zone right away. And then it's the partner zone. She's
not
an
even
asshole.
In the friend zone. She doesn't even like him.
Well,
she doesn't want to make any time for him.
But using that expression, as they said on Friends many years ago, I just learned that recently, that Friends is where that phrase was copped. Joey said it to Ross about Rachel. So we use that for this example. And then Cusack, Craig, is obsessed with Maxine the rest of the way. And I don't really know why, because it's not like she's even nice to him. And he feels like, I got a shot. But then this whole point is, I'll take over Malkovich so I can be with Maxine. It's not take over Malkovich so I can be rich or even just wealthy, because obviously Malkovich is an actor of some renown, which is doing okay. But then he makes him be a puppeteer. One of the nice touches in this movie, actually, is that whole thing where puppeteering becomes this big story. Enough to get on television, and we see the little cameos from Sean Penn, Brad Pitt, David Fincher. There's that great line, too, about Malkovich teaching other puppeteers. Your puppet weeps, yet you yourself are not weeping. He's so into it. Somehow he makes a living doing this, too, but becomes famous. That's one of the funny things about the film, because that's, of course, silly and absurd. A puppeteer doesn't... Well, then again, we just talked about it last week. Jim Henson and Frank Oz, too, for that matter, got famous being puppeteers. So I guess you can be, but you have to be a Muppeteer, more so.
It's certainly not an easy job to break into.
And to make money at, really.
Oh, my God, yeah. Especially the kind of puppeteering Craig is doing, which is not for kids.
Well, when we see the movie open up, we see curtains pulling back. It's an old school touch in films. I think Moulin Rouge did that a couple years later, too. But that also is revealing Craig's puppet. He's performing at home, preparing for a show he'll do on the street. Like you say, not for kids, when the kid sees what he's doing with his puppet. But that's the way the movie does start. And at the very end, he's in Emily's portal, watching on helplessly. That's a great touch. We'll get to that a little later on. Because he isn't making it as a puppeteer, but does have fast hands, he goes to the Merton Flemmer building, the 7th and a half floor. That's a great touch. The deaf secretary, Mary Kay Place, she's in the movie just enough to be funny, because it's a gag that could get old fast, but I don't think it does. And that reveals Dr. Lester's speech impediment. I'm sorry if you don't understand a word I'm saying. Dr. Lester, you're speaking fine.
Such a great gag, and it just keeps paying off in dividends. I love The Seventh and a Half Floor. It is such an absurd concept. We never really find out why it exists. That short video that Craig and Maxine are made to watch with its bizarre explanation for the existence of a half floor remains to me one of the funniest underplayed jokes in cinema. It's just so pitch perfect in its corporate absurdity. For anyone who doesn't remember, the explanation is that a wealthy man falls in love with a woman who's a little person, and he makes a seventh and a half floor so that the ceilings don't mock her height. It doesn't make any sense. And we never get an adequate explanation for it. But it's just the gift that keeps on giving for interesting and absurdly funny visuals, kind of like a metaphor for corporate spendthrifting on just how much a corporation is willing to put its employees through.
They pass the savings on to you.
Yeah, for the low overhead. But the funniest thing to me is the way that everybody who works there just simply accepts it. They crouch and they lean and they crane their necks and they never question whether or not they deserve the privilege of standing up straight.
And they also have to work on that crazy elevator. Yes. You gotta time it just right so you can climb off without being too far low or high.
And they don't overdo that. I think you only ever see it twice. The first time when you see how it works.
Octavia Spencer is in
that
scene.
Yes.
Future Oscar winner. She was in Bad Santa a couple years later in a very small cameo for that film too. So she was
Opal.
Barely in films for many years until she finally broke out about 10 years after this, give or take. When Craig meets Maxine, he of course does the whole name guessing thing. That's one of the great scenes in this movie too. I can't remember what he says all, but he finally somehow comes across Maxine, which is not a name I'd ever think to guess. And then she has to have a drink with him. But later on, when he's gone through Malkovich's portal and comes out and explains how I could never go back to the way it was before, I couldn't keep on living. Her gesture to the window is one of the great wordless gestures in the history of movies. It's one of those things, if you haven't seen the movie, you'll never get. Why would you listen to this podcast if you haven't seen this movie? But you would never get what I'm talking about unless you saw the movie. Just that, well, then jump.
Yeah, she's just trying to reject him, and he will not accept it.
But the key relationship in the film, I guess, is the married couple, Lottie and Craig. They're not happy from the beginning. That's a very key point in this movie. Why it is a sad film, because it's not like they had a happy marriage that was ruined by him going through Malkovich, and then she goes through, and right away, I'm a changed woman.
She thinks she's transgender.
After 15 minutes of being inside someone else's head. But Lottie brings up a baby early on, which he doesn't want then. He doesn't say that, but you can tell he doesn't want a baby with her, or maybe with anybody. It may not just be her. Even with Maxine, had he gotten her, maybe he wouldn't want a baby with her either. But then at the very end of the film, he becomes, in a way, her baby.
Yeah.
Maxine says, and it's Maxine's literal baby, but she says that I got pregnant when you were inside Malkovich. Well, it's still Malkovich's baby, but okay, fine. So those two really, in a way, are father and mother of Emily at the very end of the film, in Maxine's mind at least, and I guess maybe Lottie's as well. But this bad marriage between Lottie and Craig is darker than I'd remembered it being. I'd forgotten entirely that he puts her in the cage. Well, I think I'd remember that part. He puts her in the cage with Elijah, but then he pulls a gun on her. He's willing to shoot her if he had. Well, maybe he wouldn't have actually shot her, but he's insinuating he would shoot her just to get back into Malkovich, just to try to get with Maxine, who's made it clear she doesn't want him in the first place.
I would argue that it's less about their marriage being bad and more about Craig just being a through and through bad person. He has no redeeming qualities. Maybe part of the reason the movie is hard to find like an emotional entry point to, because if there's a lead character in this film, it's Craig. He's the one that you should be identifying with, but he's awful.
He's probably worse than the two women. Malkovich isn't really a bad guy.
Yeah, Maxine is at least straightforward. What you see is what you get. Yes. She's mean, she's cutthroat, she's greedy, and she's selfish, but she never pretends and manipulates and lies to people. She just is exactly who she is.
And Dr. Lester and his friends going through Malkovich at the end and then wanting eventually to go into another portal many years on. How does that work anyway? They all go in there and they all, what? They can't all control a body.
What are you going to do? Were you really, really going to overthink it this much?
Yes. That's what we do in this podcast, especially a movie that's all about thinking.
So you have all these people who are in Malkovich's mind, and there's like a good 20 people that go with him. And then he's going to bring yet another 20 people when he, 40 years later, transfers into...
Gary Sinise, maybe.
So when Emily is about to turn 44, he's going to take another 40 people, including the 40 people that are already in his mind.
Do they share this person every day? They all get a turn for a month or than a month?
If you really want to go for a good round of reasonably good questions with this film, you could tear it apart very easily. But the tone of it just begs you to go along with it and say, well, to hell with it.
Very true.
The genius of it is that it never over-explains its premise. There is a portal. How did it get there? Doesn't matter. it exists. This person knows it exists. Was it witchcraft? Is it science? Who knows?
And this version of Dr. Lester wasn't always Dr. Lester. It was the guy from long ago who made this building.
I guess that makes Dr. Lester Malkovich's father? Because they automatically know that Emily is the next conduit. So that means Dr. Lester must be related to Malkovich.
I hadn't thought of that before.
I just thought of it now.
But inside Dr. Lester is somebody from many years ago.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Some old pirate guy or something. I'm going to skip ahead to what happens next because we're talking about the very end of the film and Dr. Lester and his people and Craig, in a way, too, being an Emily. He's trapped. He's in the subconscious. One of the many connections, people have talked about this the last few years since Get Out came out. It's almost as if Catherine Keener, who was in this movie and then in that movie, grew up to have a daughter, and that was Allison Williams. Well, Emily in this, I guess. And then they do this very sinister thing. What they're doing, this movie isn't really sinister, and that it is. But my what happens next is a little bit sidebar from that, because Craig is trapped, but he had the ability earlier to control Malkovich when he didn't originally, and no one else was doing it. Somehow he found a way, because he's a puppeteer, I guess. But this is pretty sinister, but I think that what could happen next is that Craig finds a way to control Emily long enough to kill herself so he can end his torture. Because she's only, what, 5 or 6, 7 years old? Look away, stop looking at your mother, no, oh no, Maxine. Or he wants to control her long enough, meaning Emily, to seduce her mother so he can have one last boink.
What?
I told you it was going to be dark.
Yeah, that's weird.
This is being John Malkovich.
It seems like a fitting punishment that he's stuck at Emily, that he will have no control, that he has to spend, I guess, the next 44 years, but maybe even longer. What happens when all those other people then occupy her brain and he's already in there?
And of course, we also go back to the fact he was inside of Malkovich for 8 months, supposedly. How do you survive? How do you eat and drink and breathe?
His corporeal body.
Yes, and now many years, not just 8 months, inside of Emily.
It's no fun to really pick this movie apart.
Of course it's fun to pick
this
movie apart.
I mean, it is,
it's always fun to do that.
It's not like Interstellar, where you can actually have Neil deGrasse Tyson spoiling it for you one way or another and really pick apart the science. It's a fantasy.
I like how Craig talks about it. He took a plank in with him inside of Malkovich the first time, and it doesn't come out with him. He even says that to Maxine. I had a piece of wood. It's not with me now. Where is it? But it's stuck inside of Malkovich's head, which is also odd. But it does finally come out at the end when he is kicked out. Or I guess he lets himself get out because he has no choice. If he doesn't, then they're going to kill
Maxine.
Is it Maxine? Yeah. They've kidnapped her. And Maxine and Lottie go through Malkovich's subconscious. The only time that Maxine ever goes inside of Malkovich, and she never does in the way that we see both Craig and Lottie do it, and other people, obviously, where they're just voyeurs. She's in his subconscious. She's never doing that kind of stuff. That's also really dark, too, when we see some of the things that Malkovich supposedly went through as a kid.
Oh, my God, the little boy. What is he saying? I'm bad. I'm bad. I'm bad.
Watches his parents. I think it's supposed to be his parents having sex.
Yeah, that's right.
And the thing you're talking about being bad, yeah. Being teased. Little Johnny pees his pants or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
The whole thing about being spit out of the New Jersey Turnpike feels like it was either a drinking binge one night, if Kaufman even drinks, I don't know, or maybe a pot session or LSD or something, because it's such a bizarre touch.
Then again, this banal,
is,
too.
This guy's so creative. I mean, that's the idea, is let's do something really weird by having you go inside somebody's brain, but then when you're spit out, it's nearby, not so far that Craig can't drive to meet these people afterwards, and is waiting for them. So either he drives fast, or that is really close to where their office is, I think in Manhattan, I'm not even sure where they're supposed to be, but it's New Jersey's Turnpike. And then, of course, they land from a long way up there. In fact, when Maxine's kicked out of the subconscious, she is 8 months pregnant and lands. I'm fine. But I guess, again, we're talking about fantasy, so you let it go. But going back to the middle of the movie, I guess you could say, early part of the film, when Maxine goes over to the Schwartz's for dinner, both Craig and Lottie come on to her. One of the funny sequences, they both basically dive on her. But she only wants Malkovich. And then ideally, and I guess maybe primarily, when Lottie's in there. I don't think she really wants Malkovich per se. It's only when Lottie's actually inside of her. But she has a chance to have a three-way with them or even just say, Lottie, I want to be with you. But none of that happens until the end of the film when she realizes, I loved you all along. But then that means they both have to be lesbians.
No, they're bisexual.
But they work out there. So is it cheating to go into someone else's head and sleep with a different man, meaning Lottie, because she is the one inside of Malkovich more than once when she's with, well, then she's sleeping with a different woman. But is she cheating on Craig? And is Craig cheating on Lottie?
Okay, so I would say yes, because the very intention was for Lottie to go into Malkovich's head and have sex with Maxine under exactly those circumstances.
So if this was real and I did that, you would think I was cheating.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess I'd have to agree
with
that.
I think that's fair. Yeah, but if you just happen to enter the portal, assuming that you'd be eating toast and reading the New York Times, and instead Malkovich just happened to be having sex with somebody because he's in control of himself and can make his own decisions, is that cheating? No.
You know one of the great touches in this film, especially from a sound design standpoint, is when that first happens. The first time we ever see Craig go into Malkovich's mind, not knowing what's going to happen. and he hears the toast and that
the
sound.
Crunching.
If you ever plugged your ears when eating certain foods, like toast or chips or something, it does sound like that.
I know. I don't know how they did that. It sounds exactly like what eating toast sounds like inside your head.
Look, that Malkovich's life, more often than not, is really dull. He's eating toast and having breakfast. He's ordering things from, I don't know if it's supposed to be IKEA, but yeah. He's ordering things from a store. Do you have the periwinkle blue? No, that's fine. I'll get this other thing. So even though that might be a great metaphor for how New York will eat you up and spit you out, as it literally spits people out on the turnpike, the best sequence in the whole film, though, when you talk about people going inside their brains, and the most red-letter moment in the whole film, is when Malkovich goes into his own portal.
Oh, yeah.
And all he hears is people saying Malkovich in different ways. The singer, the people talking, people that are supposed to be women.
And because this film was made in 99, most of those actors are just actors wearing masks. But then in every shot, usually Malkovich himself is dressed in one character or another. And that's what the camera kind of focuses on. The first time you watch it, it truly looks like it's a room full of Malkoviches, which is impressive for 1999. When you've watched it a few times, you start looking around and paying attention. You can see which ones are masks and which ones are the real Malkovich. But it's really cool.
Mm-hmm. Not a big budget movie, so you gotta cut a little bit of slack on that one, I guess.
Plus, it was 99. I don't even know if special effects were there yet.
You could argue they were with The Phantom Menace, because as much as people rip on that movie, the visual effects were pretty
impressive. Did not have Star Wars budget,
for that time frame. Yes, that also had a huge budget, of course, being Star Wars. And the first movie back from all those years later on. One of the most anticipated movies of all time was The Phantom Menace. But then when Malkovich gets spit out and he's pissed off, getting hit in the head by that beer can, that was written in the screenplay. I've read that was an improv. That was somebody on the... No, it wasn't. It wasn't somebody driving by. They shut down those kinds of highways. Even if they didn't shut down the highway, no one would have known it was John Malkovich. He's wearing a baseball cap. And apparently that was one of John Cusack's writing partners. So maybe one of the guys who wrote High Fidelity with him. DeVicentis is one of his name. Pink. Or maybe it was even Jeremy Piven. I don't know. But one of them apparently hit him on the head on the first try. Hey, Malkovich, think fast! Ow!
So apparently Cusack asked his agent to present him with the craziest, most unproducible script you can find. And this is what he got.
What do you think of John Cusack in this movie? And more importantly, what do you think about his career in general? Chris and I covered him not long ago in Eight Men Out, where he's fine. Not convincing as a baseball player so much, especially with his swing. His fielding's okay in that movie. And then you and I covered Stand By Me years ago, and I think he's really good in that small role as the older brother who died. But most of the things he's made in the past decade have been dreck. People rip on Nicolas Cage all the time, and they go after Johnny Depp for all the things he's been doing lately. Although his movies have mostly gotten a budget compared to Cage and Cusack. But I think of all those guys, Cusack's the one who's had a hell of a career just like them, but has done nothing memorable for a long time. And it's like he's just phoned it in. I don't know. He seems like he doesn't really care in his movies anymore. Maybe he does, but doesn't seem to. But anyway, what do you think about that when you think about him in this lead role in this very strange movie?
I just never loved him. He's never really seemed to me like the type of person who really belongs in the starring role of a movie, and maybe he's just been luckier than most, and he was a cute teenager, but I didn't really follow him into adulthood, and I feel like he's probably the type of guy who's lucky just to get leading roles, even if they're in dreck.
Well, whenever that happens to somebody, and they don't do good stuff, and they don't even get to be in movies that could have been big hits, because when you think about a lot of the Nick Cage movies in the 2000s especially, maybe even the 2010s, but the 2000s, things like Wicker Man could have been a big hit. It was a remake of a very famous, not very famous, I guess, but a movie that a lot of people love from the 70s, an English film. It had potential to be something special as this really odd horror film. It didn't work, but it didn't have to fail. It just did fail. And Cage was in other things that were successful in that decade. And interestingly, these three actors, Cage, Cusack, Malkovich, I mentioned Depp, but Cage, Cusack, Malkovich were all in Con Air in the late 90s together.
I think that John Cusack, as an adult, past his 30s, when he's past his cute phase, he plays a villain better than anything else. In this movie, he's well cast. He's great in High Fidelity, where he's playing, like, essentially
that movie hasn't aged very
prick.
Well.
He's so hard to watch.
Me too, it's especially, so but even just in general, the way most people try to be more woke, and even just a little bit more fair to women, the way we treat them. Yeah, I love that movie so much for so long. And I haven't seen it in a couple of years. I think next time I watch it, I'm going to look at him a lot differently. Maybe even then, they knew. He and Stephen Frears and his writers knew, because he wrote the movie along with his buddies. They adapted it from a book. Maybe they were aware and what they were doing with his character, and maybe they weren't.
I think that people like that character in High Fidelity were given permission to be jerks a lot more back then. It's like when we went to go rewatch Splash. Tom Hanks is unbearable in that movie. He's awful, and he's straight up the bad guy. He's really hard to sympathize with. Times change, and your romantic heroes are suddenly really unlikable. And he doesn't have enough likability to pull it off. But then I was even reflecting about how there's been Paul Rudd movies I haven't been able to go back and rewatch, and no matter how lovable Paul Rudd is, you go back and you watch Role Models, a lot changed in the last 10 years, and suddenly it doesn't matter how charming he is, that prick persona that was popular in the late 90s and the aughts, it's just a different day and age. It's just not fun to watch people like that. Cusack is good at playing that kind of person if he stuck to villains, or even better, if he had never been a leading man when he was younger, and he had only ever been a character actor, I think he probably would have had a much more interesting career. It's impossible to say, and I'm not sad for him. He does fine. He's a working actor.
Hollywood loves a comeback, too, so there's no reason to think that...
Maybe Cusack, Tarantino will cast him in something.
Maybe so, and no reason to think Cusack won't have some Oscar-winning part in 3 years, 5 years, 10 years from now, or Cage, or Depp, or any of the other ones I just talked about who've been forgotten, not forgotten, I guess, but down to the luck more. Costner's another one. The C's, Costner, Cage, Cusack, I always think of those three. Because Depp wasn't really in that area until more recently. Where I think people are also just sick of some of those people. Not so much Cusack, because he never was a true headlining star. Anyway, back to the storyline of being John Malkovich. One of the better moments of the film, too, is towards the end when Craig is now officially inside of Malkovich for a good 8 months. And does that puppeteering dance, which is such a strange touch, too.
It's the same dance the puppet does in the opening sequence.
Right. And that means Maxine is falling for, quote-unquote, Craig now. Because she's impressed with the fact that he can do this inside of Malkovich's body. She's a complicated character. We talked about who you want to be inside the head of. Maybe her, of all the people in this movie, because I don't really understand what she's motivated by. And she seems like she's legitimate with Lottie at the end, that she's in love with her, and they seem like they're happy together at the very end. But she never seems to like Craig. Certainly isn't in love with him at any point, but then, in a way, she is. But she's only ever seeing Malkovich, who she sleeps with a lot before that, but she doesn't really know him, per se. She's sleeping with what she thinks, and what I guess knows, is Lottie.
I think it's possible that she's just a poorly written character. It wasn't really realized. For the first two-thirds of the film, she's just such a badass who knows exactly what she wants and takes it and doesn't seem to experience any remorse. And then suddenly in the final act, she's pregnant and sad and missing Lottie, and it is not consistent with her character at all. Even if Maxine were to have discovered that she was in love with Lottie, what she would have done, Craig, you know what, I'm bored with you, I'm gone, I'm in love with Lottie, see ya. She wouldn't lament and hang up her mobile and stare off into the distance and wonder what would have become of her.
Maybe Kaufman and Jones didn't really understand their own, not lead character, because that would be Cusack, but one of their lead characters who did get nominated for an Oscar, and it was against Catherine Keener's usual type. She was interesting in things like Living in Oblivion and some of the Nicole Holofcener, I believe. She worked with her a few times in the 90s. And then she does something that's so against what she usually had done, as did Cameron Diaz. But Keener, like I said, was in Get Out, where she plays a villainous character, bona fide, full stop.
A puppeteer as well, in a way.
And also romantic lead, which is not something she's played a lot, certainly not in big-name movies, like in 40-Year-Old Virgin, about 6 years after this. But I mentioned Cameron Diaz, who got nominated for 4 Golden Globes in 5 years, and this is one of them. She and Keener were both nominated for the Globe in 99. But then no Oscar nomination for Diaz or anything else she's ever done. I think she was nominated for something about Mary, Vanilla Sky, and Gangs of New York, I believe, in that time frame. So 4 to 5 years. She's made nothing, Cameron Diaz, since 2014. She made a bunch of movies in that year, including Sex Tape, and I think Bad Teacher was that year. And I wondered why. Maybe she's a TV actress. Maybe she decided to change from being a film actress. She's not that old. She's about my age, a little bit older maybe. But she got married in 2015.
Yeah,
so
to that guy from Good Charlotte.
Oh, is that who it is?
Benji something.
And I didn't see any kids online, so it's not like she wanted to become a mother. Maybe she is, but doesn't say that online. So I don't know, maybe she just said, I've got enough money and I don't want to do this anymore. We always think that women get older and they get pushed out of the business, or maybe somebody loses their... Maybe that's actually something that's happened over the years and we just never know, that people have mental troubles and they lose their mind.
Or just traditional illnesses. That's what happened to Dana Carvey.
True.
Rick Moranis, whose wife passed away, and then he had to raise his kids.
And then said, I don't miss the business. So.
Yeah, he had enough money, so it's fine. I can just live my life.
I think we think that everyone wants to be Michael Caine and act in as many movies, Sam Jackson, act as many movies as possible every single year and make as much money as you can every single year. But some people just realize, either I don't want to do this anymore, or they won't cast me, or you're the girl from Hairspray, Nikki Blonsky, who they just want to cast because she's fat, which is stupid because she's a terrific actress and a lot of fun.
But like you say, the last two movies she was in, she was the lead. So
we're talking about Diaz again?
Diaz, yeah. So Bad Teacher and Sex Tape, she was the lead in both those films. I don't think either of them were blockbusters, but I don't think either of them were dramatic failures.
So I feel like
either.
It was her choice then.
Yeah, it probably was.
Because at that point,
and when
she
it
was...
times out around the same time that she got married.
She was around mid-40s too, and last time I saw her, she still looked pretty good, so you couldn't say that she was looking old, which hopefully that's going to start ending, that people are going to dwell on that so much.
I think it has started ending. For actresses who are aging, TV is just such a feather bed to land on. If you just want to age naturally, Catherine Keener, great example. She's done her share of television. She played like a dowdy old woman in, what is it called? That miniseries she was in with Oscar Isaac. Show Me a Hero. there's lots more roles, I think, for actresses who are over 40 and look over 40.
Unless
and,
you're Cameron Diaz and you decide not to keep doing it.
I think
it seems
she must have just decided.
Must be the case. She could always come back.
You talked earlier about your experience the first time you ever saw this movie. First time I ever saw this movie, I did see it in the theater, and I waited for the credits to roll because I was like, is that Cameron Diaz?
She looks nothing like she ever had before.
Now I think I would recognize her. I've just seen her face so much more. And I made the mistake of saying out loud, oh, that was Cameron Diaz. And then my date I was with teased me about it.
If Diaz had been in the audience with you and heard that, I bet she would have been more delighted than anyone else.
Right. She really disappears in this role, and they really managed to make her, I'm not going to say homely, because she's not homely, but she's not hot. Her hair, her makeup, and her wardrobe are just atrocious.
Cusack, too, especially with that long, stringy hair. And then when he becomes Malkovich at the end, when he truly becomes Malkovich at the end of the film for that 8 months, Malkovich has long hair.
I know, it's so awful, his skullet.
Malkovich was 44 when they made this movie, so he's long been one of those guys who looks older than he really is. A year younger than I am now. Now I have my hair, maybe that helps my appearance.
You look much younger than
Malkovich. Thank you. You said that during the movie. I was looking for that again.
Allow me to compliment you.
Chris and I covered him in Rounders last year, where, of course, he's so over the top. But then he's made a career of being an over-actor, in some ways even in this movie. I would have liked to have seen him get nominated for an Oscar for this, by the way. But that was a tough year for supporting actors. That was the year that Michael Caine won for The Cider House Rules. But Cruise was up against him for Magnolia, Michael Clark Duncan in The Green Mile, Haley Joel Osment, or as Caine called him at the Oscars, Hallie Joel Osment in Sixth Sense, and Jude Law in Talented Mr. Ripley. Another solid movie. I'm not a huge fan of, but a pretty good movie from that year. How do you get into that group? It's hard to knock anybody out of that listing. That's one of the best fivesomes in the history of any category at the Oscars. What do you think about them casting someone who we know, especially if you're a film buff, but not everyone knows who he is, and the joke about, you're that actor guy, right? Don't tell me.
Well, one of the studio execs said, why is it being John Malkovich? Why isn't it being Tom Cruise? I think he literally used the example, Tom Cruise. That would be a much more interesting concept, except that the film isn't about what is it like to be rich and famous. The film is about a love triangle, about desire, about puppeteering, about controlling other people.
An obsession.
Yeah. I think the movie would still have been interesting had it just been being Ryan Ellis. Being any random person is still, you could pull off everything about this film. Maybe just make that person
you would never get
wealthy.
That made, though.
Well, that's just it. Being John Malkovich was such a gimmick. I was in film school when this movie came out, and people were talking about it. It was so interesting to everybody. Everyone was blown away by this concept. We were all going to see it just out of curiosity alone. So it's a great gimmick.
And of course, one of the subtexts in this film, too, is the idea that actors always say you have to get inside of that character's head. Well, especially Craig, but a lot of these people, at least briefly, for him a lot longer, get to, well, they don't get to control him, do they? But they get to be inside of someone else's head, and someone that they have some knowledge of, if they're at all aware of film.
In my head is just a little boy watching his parents having sex.
Well, we talked about Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and that movie has comedy in it too. Great love story, but also some really dark stuff. And when we start going into Joel's subconscious and finding all these old memories, there's some really painful things in there. Charlie Kaufman's explored that, though. Synecdoche? I never know how to pronounce that movie.
I can never say it.
Which I believe was 10 years after this one, and he directed that as well as writing it. But Kaufman's movies are almost always funny, but they're often about loneliness and about trying to connect and not being able to.
And deep into the psychology of the subconscious and kind of the images that dominate our mind that we aren't really necessarily aware of.
And despite the supposed happy ending of Eternal Sunshine, which I just watched again on YouTube a few days ago, I still love the way that Carrie plays that scene when Kate Winslet says to him, it won't work out or it's going to be hard or something. Okay. And it's wonderful. That's beautiful. But then you have to think that this isn't going to work long term. They do not belong together. And one of the deleted scenes, whether from the screenplay or whether they actually shot it, I don't remember, is that she kept going back to that company to have Joel erased from her memory more than once. And that is sad and that is dark. So this guy really does, maybe he's had a hard life, I don't know. But if he hasn't, he's really been able to explore things that he knows nothing about. Because as funny as his movies are, they are often painful.
I was talking about the golden age of Charlie Kaufman, and the last Charlie Kaufman film I saw was Anomalisa, which is not one bit funny for even a moment. It is a straight-up depressing film. I didn't like it. It was interesting as a concept. I feel like it would have made a better 30-minute short film than a 90-minute feature. For the concept, it was important to use puppets. Well, stop-motion animation, they're not puppets, but they look similar, and obviously he is thematically going back to this concept. The scenes show interesting aesthetic choice in that movie, the design of the people in that film. But it is a downer and weird and deeper psychological sense. And again, a conceptually strange film, a little bit gimmicky, but not this irreverent, goofy, nihilistic, but still funny film.
I think you need to do that in comedies more than a lot of directors and writers and actors want to allow, or maybe studios want their comedies to be light and fun. And yet, if you think about some of the movies from this year that I've raved about often on this podcast, not just this episode, but other podcasts, Bowfinger is about people trying to connect too, and they do have a future and a career and everything like that, but they're desperately trying to make something work, and they're not good enough. They're not very talented, but you like them anyway. So the movie's funny, but if you could just strip away the comedy for a minute, it's a sad story in a lot of ways. Galaxy Quest, these people that had this cool career that other people obsess about, but they resent for the most part.
They feel like failures, even though everybody else.
And they do something cool, and they help save these aliens, and they've got a future. The show is rebooted, and the nerds win out as well. So that's more of a happy ending. But there's also some sad elements and dark elements to a lot of that movie too. American Beauty was a comedy as well, but also some really tough stuff. But if you're not going to do a flat-out Holocaust drama or a movie about savage beatings or a Passion of the Christ type film, then have your dark stuff tempered with the comedy. I don't remember Synecdoche. I think I'm saying that right. Was all that funny? But I think there was definitely some comedy. It's Charlie Kaufman. There must have been funny stuff in there.
There's comedy in it, but it's almost more of the huh type of comedy.
Okay, right.
Than something that's like really meant to make
you. But look at Adaptation, which was the next movie that Spike Jonze made, which I prefer of all of his movies. I think this one's excellent. We reviewed her as a Now Playing project quite a few years ago, so we've covered now three of the four movies that Spike Jonze has ever directed. The other one, of course, is Where the Wild Things Are. But when Adaptation came out, my favorite scene in that movie was when the two brothers are talking about how the one was rejected by a girl, but he knew.
She made fun of him. He's like, that's okay.
Yep.
That's
her
she
business.
Feels about me.
That
that's
is
not how I feel about
beautiful
me.
Yeah. And sad. Not so much funny in that one moment. But Donald, who's the fun twin, the whole movie is almost always funny. Charlie is too, but Donald is really funny in that. But then that moment, Charlie finally gets his brother. He finally gets something about love. He finally gets something about himself. That moment, when I've watched on YouTube since, has made me cry. I think it's one of the greatest things that Charlie Kaufman's ever written. But that movie can work that way of this guy who's desperately lonely and desperately trying to fit in with people and desperately trying to make it and continue to make it in Hollywood because he already made it, I guess. Have that happen, do all that stuff, but make it funny so you can have a movie that people want to see.
And humor is ubiquitous in human experience. We recently watched High Life. There's plenty to like about it, but for the most part, I don't think it was great because it was just so dour. You have people in a very dark situation, stranded in space. But if people were in that situation, they would be cracking jokes. Gallows humor is real. It exists and it gets you through some tough-ass times.
Talk to homicide detectives.
Yeah, you work in news, and I've worked news adjacent.
Somebody
here
made
and there
a joke
in my life.
On 9/11.
Oh my God.
On 9/11, one of the guys at work, I thought I said this first, but apparently he did, about the plane that got crashed in Pennsylvania. We did this on purpose. Nothing will ever go in that field again. We were saying that on 9/11 when we found out, or maybe it was the day after. Whenever we found out that that's what happened to that plane, we made jokes about it right away. That's how sick we are.
One of the biggest laughs I ever had at work, just had the giggles for like an hour about it, was over a joke that my colleague made when we were covering the Haitian earthquake. And it was one of the darkest things that I ever had to cover at work. Unforgettable imagery and stories. But when somebody finally broke the tension, it was such a relief that you can't stop laughing.
So the creative team of Kaufman and Jones worked together a few times. Kaufman, this is his first ever screenplay, and this is Spike Jonze's first ever directorial feature film. He had directed music videos and other things for a while, so he wasn't really new to movies per se. It wasn't like he just came out of doing nothing at all. He'd had quite a career before that. But you look at Kaufman's writing credits on TV first. Get a Life, The Edge, recognize these? The Trouble with Larry, Ned and Stacy. Then he started writing these movies, and then he did a few more TV screenplays. But he was one of those people that was languishing in writers' rooms, probably feeling like he was wasting his time until he could come up with some of these odd scripts. And you see Bing John Malkovich on here, Human Nature, Adaptation, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, the brilliant Eternal Sunshine, then Synecdoche, Anomalisa, and he's got a few things in the works. He probably isn't one of the writers that people put on a pedestal in Hollywood the way they should. Aaron Sorkin certainly on that list, and Tarantino as a writer-director, and many other people. But those are some interesting and unusual and weird scripts, just like Jonze's four movies are interesting, weird, and one of a kind.
I found this great quote from him, which I'll butcher because I didn't have the brains to write it down. He has such a hard time getting scripts made because he still just has such a weird sensibility, and Hollywood is just too chicken to make his films. And let's face it, on this list there are a lot of movies that haven't made that much money, like Schenectady and Anomalisa weren't hits by any means, but he said that he'll constantly read reviews where people will describe the script as Kaufman-esque, and he's like, well, why does a Kaufman-esque script get made and mine doesn't? Why don't you make an actual Kaufman script? So even he has trouble getting films made, because studios still want to see dollar signs.
That's probably more true now even than it was 20 years ago when he made this one. Well, his next thing in the works, and it looks like it's in post-production, so I guess they actually made it, is I'm Thinking of Ending Things. Now, that's an appropriate title for a Charlie Kaufman movie. He wrote and directed it based on a book by somebody named Ian Reed.
Oh, yeah, Toni Collette. That's good. Jesse Plemons. Ooh, I like what I see so far. Mm.
So yeah, huge kudos to Jones and Kaufman. What a creative bunch. And one of the producers on this movie, along with Steve Golan, Vincent Lende, and Sandy Stern, was Michael Stipe from R.E.M.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Spike Jonze directed an R.E.M. video. Spike Jonze shot skateboard videos. He worked with Jackass. But I think he made his name mostly for directing some of the best, most creative, outstanding music videos of the 90s. I was obsessed, still am kind of obsessed with music videos. And I have his DVD compilation. And I've watched it 100 times. Mm-hmm. Such a great creative mind when you have the freedom of music videos to do whatever you want. And performer, too. The video for Praise You, which unfortunately would have no impact now because it's been copied so much, but when it came out, was absolutely mind-blowingly brand new and refreshing.
Unless we forget, he acted only a few weeks ago for us in Three Kings.
Yeah, so that's right.
Same year he was directing this movie, he was in that one. And they both came out basically the same time of year. Three Kings was out in the fall, I believe,
yeah,
and this was out, December 3rd.
Incidentally, as much as he is talented, and I agree that he's talented, he comes from a wealthy family, so he could always pursue whatever he wanted to pursue, but he got this script when it was passed to him by his father-in-law at the time, Francis Ford Coppola.
And then later on, he worked with his cousin-in-law, Nicolas Cage, when he was still married to Sofia Coppola. They're not married anymore, but I think they still were. Yeah, they were, I think, during adaptation.
And he is, by proxy, played by Giovanna Ribisi in Lost in Translation.
Sofia Coppola can deny it all she wants to, but that because Sofia Coppola would have known Cameron Diaz working on this movie, and Cameron Diaz, for all of her faults, seems like a fun, bubbly person who would be borderline obnoxious with you about, you have to try this thing I did, it's great, it's awesome, spend your money, do this kind of thing. And the way that Anna Faris plays that is so Cameron Diaz, I think in a way complimentary, because she's a fun, bubbly person, it seems like anyway. And yes, Giovanna Ribisi seems to be playing Spike Jonze a lot in that movie, too. And Lost in Translation is a good segue into The Cameraman, because Lance Accord shot that, and he shot this, and he shot Adaptation. Only 9 movies, though. Now he's producing. Because I looked at his resume and thought, why is he not making movies? Did he die? Or has he got something wrong with him? Like, we thought maybe Cameron Diaz might, but no, he's producing. So he's a pretty good cameraman. Those are decent-looking movies. They're not the best thing about them is the camera work, but anyway, the cinematography is pretty solid. The movie's 185:1. DVD is what we watched, incidentally. The cutter, Eric Zumbrunnen, cut all 4 of Jones's films along with John Carter. No one really cared about that one. And then we're hearing the music of Carter Burwell again because he was the musician, the composer on Three Kings. Now this, we know from the Coens movies for so many years, but he's been nominated for 2 Oscars, not Coens, 3 Billboards, and Carol in recent years. What do you think of the look, the cutting, and the music score?
I think the technicals are all B+. Nothing really blows you away. The main star is the script, and of course the performances. The technicals just don't get in its way.
Well, a movie like this, that's what you want. They don't need to. It's not a technical kind of movie. Now, like Star Wars was that same year where that movie's all about technicals. Mm. Forget performances because they didn't get a chance to give one or just didn't bother to give one. So a few connections. We've already mentioned Get Out a few times and people have made that link for the last couple of years long before us. I think Inside Out as well because that little girl, well, we all do, I guess, apparently, but especially the main character has little things inside of her head, whatever you want to call them, and a lot of them, the 5 main ones, but also the other ones that are work underneath, and her imaginary friend, Bing Bong, one of the great scenes of all time. We're going to cover Inside Out next year, I think. It'll be 5 years old. And Inner Space as well, people bring that one up. That was from 87, I think, the late 80s anyway. And also in Adaptation, I think it's the very beginning of the film, we see Malkovich and Cusack and Keener, who's actually in the movie throughout, it's just Catherine Keener, supposedly behind-the-scenes stuff for this movie.
Yeah, we see them on set. I think it's on the day that all the actors in the masks. And then they say, those masks are hot. So
Malkovich himself.
Make your break.
It's almost like the director. Right. All right, everybody, let's get this take. Everyone's hot. Maybe Malkovich really did that. But they're playing off this was actually on the set. Cusack, I think, is on the screen for seconds. And the Charlie Kaufman version, which of course Cage is playing, says some, "Hey, John," and he just walks past him without even acknowledging him. And that's fun too, because again, you've got the Con Air guys back together again. So anyway, what are your last thoughts on being John Malkovich, Malkovich, Malkovich?
It's not a masterpiece, but it is miles ahead of most movies in terms of creativity and gutsiness. Where are cinematic minds like this right now in 2019? Why isn't anybody giving them money to make their movies?
Yeah, looking at Kaufman's resume, it's still on our screen here. So the last thing he made was Anomalisa. That could be partly him taking a long time with these things, but his scripts 2 years apart, 1 year apart, then 2 years apart, then four, then seven, then five. So maybe it's him working slowly, but it'd be nice if he could get a movie made once every couple of years. Then again, Tarantino takes a long time between films, and so does PTA.
Sure. You know there's other Charlie Kaufmans out there trying to get their movies made, but studios just don't want to take a chance
on
them.
This is partly what Scorsese was talking about lately. Everyone wanted to take the, he hates Marvel, clank on Twitter. And his whole point, I knew at the time, without even having read what he said, that he meant it deeper than that. And I guess in the end, if you could nutshell what Scorsese was saying, is this factory filmmaking of Marvel, as good as it might be for other people, and it's not my taste, is what he was saying. And I agree with him. He's 77, whatever, years old. How could it be his taste? But his real point in the end was the interesting films, the unusual films that might be mid-budget or even low-budget are going to get made a lot less often and shown on big screens a lot less often than ever before. Yeah, you can go to Netflix, you can go to Amazon, you can go to other streaming services that are going to be out there and probably get your product made. Maybe more so now than ever because you have all those options. But a filmmaker like him wants to have it on the big screen. I'm sure Spike Jones agree with that.
We can have both. It's already happening more where Netflix and other streaming services are starting to produce great independent films. Oh God, I just want them to start greenlighting more weird, daring things. Take a chance. I know it's not always going to work out, but then when it does, you actually change the landscape.
I'm the one that said a few months ago when we did Green Book that I don't really care for the theater experience anymore anyway, so I guess I shouldn't be criticizing that.
I care for it in the sense that it forces me to pay attention. When we're in the theater, we truly have no distractions, and you get a better immersive experience of any film that way. But other than that, everything about going to the theater is annoying.
All right, excellent film, despite some of the surprising sadness in it.
Or because of some of the surprising sadness in it.
Yeah, like Eternal Sunshine.
Yeah.
Those movies are probably better for being not so light and fluffy. And just pure funny, because they're both funny, but maybe they're at their best when they're not, in some strange ways. All right, in 7 days, we're going to watch Jamie Foxx and Christoph Waltz ride around the Deep South killing slave owners in Quentin Tarantino's Django Unchained. We've reprogrammed. We were going to do something else in this slot, but people seem to love the Tarantino podcast. Pulp Fiction, Reservoir Dogs, especially Inglourious Bastards earlier this year did really well, so we're ratings whores.
We're giving the people what they want. And we're Marvel. That's what we are.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
Take that, Scorsese.
Interesting, though, this movie was a Tarantino film, of course, so it's not anything close to mainstream, but it was a big hit, especially by his standards. Just like this year, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, by his standards, was a monster hit. But for a movie like that, that's that long, okay, maybe the stars helped, Pitt and DiCaprio. Anyway, Tarantino has been a moneymaker for quite a long time now, and he still gets his movies shown on the big screen. Glamorous December releases, sometimes 70mm, in fact. Okay, so the coming attractions trivia for Django Unchained. Samuel L. Jackson has often been the very best part of Quentin Tarantino's flicks. He's also often died in the Tarantino films. So how many times did QT kill him off? And which of those was the best death?
Alright, so for the answer to that, please check out our next podcast about Django Unchained. In the meantime, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite, subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify, where all of our hundreds of episodes are available for free. And that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 list of the best American films ever made, and many, many more titles. Perhaps in exchange for all of this great content, you could leave us a rating and a review that helps people find us. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. Oh, and once more, we would like to warmly thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 20% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. And that's all one word, TOP100PROJECT, and it is not case sensitive.
So let's go to our portals. We both have one.
Yes.
You can go be inside the gymnast, and I'll go be inside of Jeff Bridges or Bill Clinton. Why is this man inside of my head? The dude will not abide that.
And cut.
The dude does abide.